British Public Radio. Nature.
Coming up this week, there's a lot we don't know about ice.
There are really interesting questions about the structure of ice surfaces that still remain to be answered.
And predicting behaviour from genetics alone, in yeast at least.
So in a sense you can say this is personalised medicine for yeast, where we can actually predict an individual's phenotype from the genotype based on this genetic study.
Plus the case of the missing crust, nothing to do with bread. I'm Thea Cunningham.
And I'm Kerry Smith. Ice is a pavement menace, but it's also a key player in many of the most important processes on the planet, from shaping the climate to carving out mountain ranges. And yes, in a comment piece this week in Nature, we discover just how much is still unknown about ice on a molecular scale. Noah Baker went to seek some icy answers from chemist Angelos Michaelides. He's at the aptly named ICE Materials Lab at University College London. As any self-respecting scientist might, Angelos had a bucket of ice cubes and some super-chilled water at the ready. And as any self-respecting reporter might, Noah first asked him why we should care about freezing water.
One of the particular things I look at is how ice forms. And, you know, the freezing of water, so going from liquid water to solid ice, is one of the most, probably the most common everyday process that happens on Earth. So we simply should want to understand this fundamental everyday process. But it's incredibly complex and we still don't understand all the details. One thing we know is that it's very easy to supercool water. So we can take liquid water and cool it down to below 0 degrees and still keep it in a liquid state. And so what we have here is an actual demonstration where I've got some liquid water in a bottle. So you can see that it's minus 4 degrees. We can gently take the bottle out and we can try and pour it.
So yeah? This water is freezing literally in your hand into this sort of slush as you pour it.
So I'm pouring it out of the bottle, and it initially in my hand I had an ice cube, and as the water lands on the ice cube, this helps to structure it into some little ice crystallite. Once this crystallite gets big enough, then it's easy. It's downhill all the way in terms of energy. But getting this so-called critical nucleus to form, to nucleate, this is a major challenge. And usually a surface will facilitate that, which allows the water molecules more readily to form an ordered structure.
So you've spoken about the structure, and I mean, I'm looking at this ice now in this bucket, and it just looks like ice to me, but I think there's more to it. Is that true?
So the ice that we encounter in everyday life, so the ice that makes snowflakes, the ice we have in glaciers, it's comprised of hexagonal arrangements of water molecules. And that normal ice that we meet every day, that's called ice one. But it turns out that so far there have been identified 15 different phases of ice. You know, we won't find them on Earth, but inside our solar system, outside our solar system, where we have conditions where we have much, much higher pressures, then we can form these different phases of ice.
So that's what we do know about ice structures and ice phases, but what don't we know?
So one question that's really hotly debated, and it goes back to the time of Michael Faraday, and that is the presence or the absence of a thing called the quasi-liquid layer. So if we take an ice crystal and we cleave it to expose a surface, then even below 0 degrees, we can form a thin liquid film of water on top of this ice surface.
And what are the implications of this quasi-liquid layer? I mean, why is it so important?
So one thing it's implicated in is whether we can make snowballs. So when we take snowflakes and we compact them together, whether our snowball is stable or not. Of course, whether or not we can make snowballs is a small issue. But big issues are, you know, in the context of environmental chemistry. And so the ice surface catalyzes a lot of the chemical reactions that take place in the upper atmosphere.
Speaking of environmental effects, ice can act as a sort of storage device for gases and impurities. Is that true?
On Earth, there's a whole class of materials, ice-like materials, that contain dissolved gases. And these are known as clathrates. And these clathrates, so first, they're a huge source of natural gas, of methane. So many industries, many companies see these as a potential source of energy for the future. They're also a potential environmental hazard, because as the ice caps melt, there's an increased chance of the natural gas that is encaged in the clathrates escaping. This is a greenhouse gas, and so this is a potential net warming effect on the globe.
So scientists, ice scientists, have been working on ice and on this problem for literally hundreds of years, and you still don't seem to have come to a conclusion. Why is it? What's so difficult about ice?
Well, one of the particular challenges is, you know, is say this first question of understanding how ice forms. So this is what we call a nucleation process. And generally, nucleation processes are very fast. So they might happen in something like a billionth of a second. And they involve a very small number of molecules. And so if we want to look at this experimentally, then we need a technique that gives us simultaneously extremely high spatial resolution and extremely high temporal resolution. These machines just aren't out there. We can either image an ice crystal or we can look at something very fast, but simultaneously we can't do both. So far, we're our best understanding about the molecular level details of how an ice crystal forms has come from computer simulation. It's still a challenge, though, because the forces that hold water molecules together are small and are incredibly delicate. So we require some of the world's largest computers to simulate these processes.
Angelos Michaelides at UCL. The comment piece is at nature.com/nature, and it's by another ice scientist in Switzerland, Thorsten Bartels-Rausch.
Coming up in the research highlights, dangerous cats and gold-digging bacteria. But first, from blood type to intelligence, all our traits are influenced to some degree by genes. They're heritable. It stands to reason that we should be able to find the genes responsible for passing on these traits, but here is where geneticists have been stumped. In many cases, no matter how hard scientists search, they cannot find enough DNA variations to account for the heritability of a trait. This is known as the missing heritability problem. Scientists at Princeton University in New Jersey have started to unravel this problem in yeast by looking not just at the genes themselves, but how those genes interact. Ewan Calloway asked team leader Leonid Kugliak about the new study.
The classic example for this has been human height. About 80% of variation in height between individuals is explained by genetic factors. And yet, very large genetic studies have been carried out to find those factors, and they find maybe in the range of 10 to 20% of the heritable variation that we know should be there.
What are some of the ideas floating out there about where is this missing heritability for traits like height?
Right. So there is a large number of ideas that have been proposed. Some of the key ones are that the number of factors is extremely large, and the effects of every individual factor are so small that even these very, very large studies involving upwards of 100,000 individuals can't find them. Another possibility is that most of the contributors to this are much more rare. They're different every time you go from one individual to another. And another possibility is that either due to interactions between genes, where the effects of two variants are stronger than what you'd predict from just the individual effects of each one, or the part that we think is heritable is greater than what you should in principle be able to find in these studies.
So then how do you go looking for missing heritability in yeast traits?
They're essentially two steps that we take. One is to carefully measure the heritability, both the factors that act independently of each other, the additive part of the heritability, and all effects of genetic factors combined, including interactions between them. And then we can scour the genome for specific regions that contribute.
What kind of traits are we talking about?
The traits that we measure here are growth traits, so essentially how well yeast cells grow in different stressful conditions, so we can expose them to unusually high or low temperatures or add specific drugs or other chemicals that make life more stressful for them. So one of the traits we did is where what we give them to eat is maltose instead of glucose, which is what they usually like. And then you compare how their growth is affected by the stress.
So for this trait, I'm just going to use this as an example. For this trait, this ability to live on maltose, were you able to explain all the heritability in this trait, all the genetic factors that contribute to it?
Right. And I mean, the case of maltose is actually a little bit unusual because there we were able to detect, in addition to the additive effects of the factors, a strong interaction between two regions of the genome, one on chromosome 7 and one on chromosome 11, where our prediction based on just the additive effects of all the factors wasn't that great. And then when we factored in this interaction, we could do much better. On average, what we see for a trait is that the interactions contribute somewhere between a quarter and a third of the variation, with the extremes being, you know, from almost none to a little more than half.
But there are other traits, right, where the heritability simply adds up. You say in the paper that how yeast grow on lithium is almost completely determined by just about 20 genetic factors. Is that one of the take-home messages of your paper, that you can predict how yeast will behave just by looking at its genome?
Right, exactly. So in a sense, you can say this is personalized medicine for yeast, where we can actually predict an individual's phenotype from the genotype based on this genetic study.
People hope to be able to do this with human genomes. What lessons can we learn from your yeast study to apply to studying human genomes?
What we would argue based on this study is that we don't think the explanation is that there is a huge number of factors with such tiny effects that we'll never find them. So in a sense, it's a hopeful message. If you look hard enough, you can find at least the additive factors in a reasonably sized doable study. The big difference, of course, between this yeast study and human studies is that this is all done within the context of a single family. So you have one set of parents and then a very, very large number of progeny. So you've isolated only a portion of the genetic variation in the species that's present in those two starting parents. In the human population, we know from the genome-wide association studies that many traits are very highly complex on the population level. Our experience has been that many of the features of complex trait genetics that we've found in yeast over the last decade or so do translate to human genetics, but with additional complexities.
Your study is a hopeful message for people looking for the genetic basis of human traits. Does it give them any clue about how or where to look?
Well, it certainly suggests that to the extent that it's practical, going back to large families, which used to be kind of the mainstay of human genetics, but then got replaced by large population studies, might be a fruitful approach. Some of the very first successes of human genetics, for example, mapping the gene for Huntington's disease, was done in precisely that way in a very large Venezuelan family and another large family. And I think those types of approaches had fallen by the wayside for a number of years while the genome-wide association studies were in their ascendancy.
Leonid Krugliak there. Research Highlights Now with Noah Baker.
It's the great dream of alchemy to turn common metals into gold. But a species of bacteria can already spin gold. The bacterium in question lives on the surface of gold nuggets, so researchers wondered if it was capable of making the element. They exposed it to a gold solution and found that tiny gold particles formed outside its cells. It looks like the bacteria secrete a little protein fragment that binds gold ions together to form nanonuggets. The team suggests it's a defense mechanism against the toxic effects of dissolved gold. The bacteria could one day be used to collect gold from mine waste. You can find the study in the journal Nature Chemical Biology. Your cat may look cute and cuddly, but it could be wreaking havoc on local wildlife. Researchers have reviewed studies on pet cats, farm cats, and feral cats and estimate they're killing up to 4 billion birds and 20 billion mammals in the United States each year. That could make our feline friends the top human-related cause of death for birds and animals, outranking other causes such as habitat destruction or collisions with vehicles or buildings. At this rate, domestic cats could even be endangering some species in certain regions. The study was published in the journal Nature Communications.
And for a tangentially related video on why cats like being stroked so much, see youtube.com/naturevideochannel.
Onwards now to a scar in the Earth's surface.
The Earth's crust is a bit like the skin of an apple. It might not be quite as smooth. After all, there are a fair few mountain ranges, but geologists are usually happy to assume that it covers the whole planet. New crust is made when tectonic plates pull apart. But there's always an exception, isn't there? It turns out that there are a few inaccessible places under the ocean where the crust just stops. Take the southern Indian Ocean. There's a huge underwater ridge here where you'd expect to find new crust being made. But in some places, there's just a scar right through from the sea to the mantle. Henry Dick from Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute in Massachusetts has been exploring this mantle mystery. He thinks he's found the answer in an ancient geological event. Before we talked about that, I asked him about his own geological ancestry. I was reading on your website, geology's in your family.
Actually, I have antecedents that go way back. I'm a great-great-great-great-nephew of Benjamin Franklin, and I'm a great-great-nephew of Spencer Fullerton Baird, who was the founder of the U.S. Department of Fisheries and the second secretary of the Smithsonian Institution.
Standing on the shoulders of giants?
Well, maybe standing in the shadow.
Well, it's nice to have you join us on the podcast. Could you tell me what question you were asking in this paper you're just publishing here?
As many of your listeners may know, and some not be aware, there is a huge mountain range that spans the oceans called the mid-ocean ridges. And this is where the Earth's great tectonic plates are pulled apart and new ocean crust is formed in the crack due to the upwelling of the mantle, which causes the mantle to release melt. And the melt erupts in volcanoes. It's the greatest volcanic chain on Earth. And I've been looking at a similar feature down in the far South Atlantic and Indian Ocean. This is called the Marian Rise. One of the unique features of the Southwest Indian Ridge is that the crust is very thin, and in places actually missing, and the Earth's mantle is just pulled onto the seafloor.
Is this the only place on Earth where the mantle is actually exposed? There's a big scar in the crust, basically, and there's the mantle below.
People have always thought of the crust as being a continuous shell around the Earth. And so this is a very different picture of the ocean crust and plate tectonics than has existed before. And the reason why these discoveries have come so late is because these are remote oceans. We had to take an icebreaker that was built specially for the purpose up to the Arctic, and then we had to go to the Southwest Indian Ridge over many years, which is a place that a lot of people weren't too eager to work on. It's the roughest ocean in the world. And some mornings it's a little hard to get out of the rack because you'd feel more than a little unsettled as the ship is rolling 20 or 30 degrees. And the whole article would not be publishable if it weren't for my contributions of my co-author, Huayan Zhou of Tongji University, who went out and documented a key place for me where he was able to show high on the Marian Rise, high up on the ridge, that we had large areas of mantle outcropping right on top of the rise.
So let me see if I've got this straight then so far. You've had several seasick expeditions over the years to this bit of the southern Indian Ocean where underneath there are these mountains of dramatically different heights, and that's where the plates are pulling apart, and underneath there
right.
is mantle. And not only
right.
is the mantle at the deep bits, but it's all the way along this ridge, which you weren't expecting.
Yeah. Not just at the deepest bits, but way up high on the ridge, which was... Well, it was a surprise to me, too.
And why was that such a surprise? What usually causes the sort of uplift in some of those regions?
The theory for these bulges in the seafloor, these oceanic rises, was that they were supported by active mantle upwelling of hot mantle beneath the ridge. You know, it's sort of lava lamp geophysics. And that would naturally cause a bulge in the surface just because it's hot and buoyant. But then it would also... produces a huge amount of magma, which creates an enormous pile of very light rock. And that very light rock floats on top of the mantle, much like a bar of soap in a bathtub. But what we see here is we have a seafloor spreading where there's very little magma coming out, and that's inconsistent with the ridge, the big bulge being supported by hot mantle flowing up from deep in the earth. And what we've shown, actually, is what you're looking at is a major change in the composition of the Earth's mantle. It's the mantle that's lighter that's elevating these rises, not the fact that there's great big thick light crust.
And so what is it about the composition of the mantle that makes it lighter?
Well, this is really fascinating. When you melt the Earth's mantle, the residue becomes lighter. And the reason is because the element iron likes to go into the magma. And so you're removing a lot of iron from the mantle, and iron is very dense. And the element that stays behind is very light. It's magnesium. And so as you melt the mantle, it gets richer and richer in magnesium and poorer in iron, and it becomes lighter and lighter. Probably about 180 million years ago, when Africa was joined to Antarctica, there was a huge volcanic event called the Karoo. And that process created a great mass of very buoyant, very light mantle beneath southern Africa. This very light mantle became the new substrate for the Southwest Indian Ridge. And that mantle, being so light, is what causes the bulge in the Earth's gravity field in the southern oceans.
What would your geological ancestors have thought of this, Henry?
I think that the changes in geology that have occurred over the last 50 years would astound them. And they'd be tickled that some remote descendant of theirs, or some remote relative, was still involved in exploring those mysteries.
That was Henry Dick.
Finally this week, it's news time with Richard Van Norden. Hi, Richard.
Hi there. So in Japan, since the Fukushima disaster, the other nuclear plants have been slowly taken offline for routine maintenance or other operations, but hardly any of them have been restarted because there's been so much public concern about whether they're safe to start up again. In fact, only two are currently operating. And there are plans to try and restart many more, but it all hinges on a guy called Kunihiko Shimazaki, and he is among a group of geophysicists working for the country's Nuclear Regulation Authority. And what they have to do is confirm industry's claims that these plants do not face a serious earthquake threat. And our story this week is about how they're saying that geological faults underneath these reactors mean that many of these nuclear plants may be too dangerous to restart.
What studies have suggested that these geological faults might be present?
Well, what this Nuclear Regulation Authority has to do is they have to actually look at the geology under the plants and say, are there faults there and are they active, meaning have they generated an earthquake within the past 120,000 years? And they've looked specifically at these faults. So the Tsuruga plant, which is kind of in the middle north side of Japan, just 250 meters from a known fault. And the plant's owner, the Japan Atomic Power Company, says the ground shifted, it has been active, but the movement happened more than 120,000 years ago. Now, Shimazaki's experts looked at the trench and they found signs of more recent movement and say it looks like there's a fracture actually running directly beneath the plant. What's interesting is that some other experts are saying, well, we're questioning these evaluations. One guy we talked to, a paleoseismologist called Koji Ukumura, said, these guys are being overly cautious just to avoid criticism from people understandably concerned that nuclear reactors would be opened when there was a risk of an earthquake. He said to us, they think they're like Superman coming in to save us from the bad guys, you know, setting themselves up against industry. So this fraught restart process is really turning into a battle about who has authority to pronounce on whether there are earthquakes here and whether the reactors can be restarted.
How hard a time do you think they're going to face in pushing that through? I mean, what's the process from now on?
Well, we expect the report soon from this group. And supposedly, you know, this group's word goes. The government has to wait for what this group says before it can then reopen these reactors. But if they're going to be getting criticism from other scientists, their report may not be as definitive as we think. Now, even if their reports are taken as definitive and suppose they find some reactors can be reopened, well, just to open the two reactors that are open right now in Oi took a lot of time. There was a lot of public pressure and protests. And so it may take many months before the government can start to reopen these reactors. And of course, they desperately want to do this because Japan is currently running rather short on useful low-carbon power.
And moving from Japan over to Switzerland, I believe you have a story about the upcoming end for the LHC next week.
Yeah, the Large Hadron Collider is going to be shutting down on 11th of February, Monday, and it's going to be down for 2 years. So obviously nothing is going to be happening from now on for another 2 years.
And are we going to be seeing physicists pouring out onto the streets of Geneva?
Well, this break, amusingly known as LS1 for Long Stop 1, it's been scheduled for a long time. And while it's been going on, our story explains what the physicists are doing. Some of the theoretical guys are going to be scrutinising all the data that's been collected. There's actually a lot to look at. Okay, they announced they'd found this long-predicted particle that looks like the Higgs, but they're going to be looking again to try and determine the spin of this particle and to nail down its mass and behaviour to discover whether it really is the Higgs that theory predicts or something else masquerading as the Higgs. And the other thing they're going to be doing is looking at the various more difficult collision channels, which they didn't need to examine to see if they'd got the Higgs, but which might betoken new physics such as supersymmetry. But those are the theorists. What's interesting about this shutdown is that we're actually going to see some engineers going down into the LHC, these huge chambers. I mean, the largest of these instruments is like half the size of Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris. These are enormous things. And they've been inaccessible for 4 years since the LHC has been running. And the problem with the LHC back in 2008 when it was turned on was that coolant vaporized of an explosion and an entire sector of the machine was damaged and all these repairs had to be done. So what happened? The team made a decision to run the entire LHC at half power, and the Higgs has been discovered on half power. And so in 2 years' time, the LHC will be running at twice the power that it's running at now. It'll be at 14 tera electron volts by December 2014. But it's quite a complex schedule they've got. They've got hundreds of people working double shifts to put these safety measures in place. And Steve Myers, who's CERN's director for accelerators, says there's no margin. It's a very tight schedule.
So will fans of the Higgs be disappointed, or is there something big to be expected?
Well, what they'd be really excited about is to find some evidence for supersymmetry. This is a theory that says that the particles that we know about all have supersymmetric partners, a whole zoo of new particles, but we've seen no evidence for them at all inside the detectors. And so John Ellis, who's a theoretical physicist at King's College London, he says so far the analyses have gone for the low-hanging fruit and there could be something else new hidden in the data. I think in general the feeling is that the particle that's been discovered looks a bit like the Higgs, but there may be some sort of tweak when you get down to it that suggests something more complicated is going on. And it's kind of nice that they've got 2 years to think about it and the torrent of data has been poured off and they can start going through the backlog.
So there could be some more surprises in store.
Definitely.
Okay, thanks, Richard. You can read more on those stories at nature.com/news.
And that's all, folks. Next week, we've scheduled a flyby of Vesta, one of our solar system's largest asteroids. Till then, I'm Kerry Smith.
And I'm Thea Cunningham.